Okay. Before we start today, does anyone have any questions or points you want to bring up? Yeah. Right. Actually, what I want to do today is pick up where I left off last time. Last time, I really didn't get a chance to. I thought you were signaling me. I really didn't get a chance to finish the lecture. The lecture last time was on Eisenhower and nuclear sharing. Why was that issue so important? You might say it's just interesting in its own right because everyone thinks the United States from the start was determined to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons because more and more countries were able to acquire nuclear capabilities that would automatically dilute American power, and America wants to be as strong as she can, so she wants to prevent any other country from going nuclear, including the European allies, especially countries like Germany. And there's this assumption that that was American policy from the start. It's just not true. That was not the Eisenhower policy at all. It was actually very open to the idea of the European allies acquiring nuclear forces under their own control. Not just Britain and France, but even Germany, which upset a lot of people because of their experience with Germany in what was then the fairly recent past. The whole Nazi experience culminating in the Second World War. Can you really trust these people to... with their finger on the nuclear trigger. Eisenhower didn't think in those terms at all. I mean, it's like pure realism. It's like, those assumptions, it didn't matter because a country's behavior was determined by its place in the structure of international politics. Right? And when people said, you can't be serious about allowing the Germans to acquire a nuclear capability, Eisenhower said, He said, Germany was a problem in the past because Russia was weak. Now that Russia is strong, I will take a strong Germany. That's a verbatim quote. Okay. That's pure realism. It's the power relationships that determine political behavior, right? Not the inherent national characteristics of countries like Germany or Russia. It's worth noting. Because it's not necessarily to America's interest to prevent our allies in Europe from acquiring nuclear capabilities. If we don't let them go nuclear, we're going to have to defend them because we can't allow the Soviets to, basically absorb, the whole of Europe and harness all those vast economic resources of the entire continent of Europe to their own war-making machine. American security would be threatened if that were to happen. So we have to keep the Soviets at bay. But why should we carry the entire burden of doing that ourselves? And especially in a nuclear environment, you don't want to do something like that. You understand why? Because unlike in the past, nuclear weapons, or so it was believed, had a kind of peculiar characteristic in thermonuclear weapons, this is, in that the numbers really don't matter so much. Once you acquire a nuclear force of a certain level, a force that's able to absorb an enemy attack, absorb an enemy first strike, ride it out, and then go back and retaliate in a way that destroys the attacker as a functioning society. Once you acquire that capability, and you don't need all that many of these thermonuclear weapons to have that capability, as long as, something like 50 to 100 of them survive, even the strongest countries, the biggest countries in the world, countries like the United States and the Soviet Union, they couldn't survive as a functioning society after, absorbing an attack of that sort. So some people put it as low as like 30 or 40 weapons. They would weapons that you would have to be able to place on target. This is a force that would survive a first strike. It's called a second strike force. What does that mean? It means that no matter how much money the United States spends on defense, the Soviet Union is sooner or later going to be able to acquire a force of that sort. It took longer, in fact, than people expected. Maybe I should even tell you the story, because it's kind of an interesting story. It relates to a whole theory, a political science theory of policymaking. This is the famous bureaucratic politics theory. You know, remember the Utley book? Utley book is an example of a work of scholarship based on that bureaucratic politics theory of policymaking. You know, policy isn't made by the political leaders, as you know, as we're taught in school. You know, it's not like the politically responsible elected leader of the country actually makes policy. Policy is basically the product of all this, you know, all these pressures kind of, that are at work within the internal structure of the government, within the bureaucracy. He said, well, where did that idea come from? Why did it become so strong and get the hold that it did on thinking about these things, especially in, like, in the 1970s or so, this whole bureaucratic politics theory of how policy works? And the answer is that a lot of it had to do with these extraordinary observations that were made about Soviet strategic forces in the 1950s. These people were not building a survivable force. You know, they were, for bureaucratic reasons, it was thought. The Soviets were building a force that didn't make sense in strategic terms. They were deploying their bombers close to the periphery of the Soviet Union, where they were just sitting ducks for an American attack because they wouldn't have enough warning system to get these things off the ground. And not only that, but the bombs and the bombers were under separate political control. The KGB, you know, Soviet secret police, they controlled the bombs. The Soviet Air Force controlled the bombers. These things were like 50 miles away up there in the Arctic. You know, it took hours and hours to kind of mate the bombs with the bombers. You know, it's like the Americans who studied these things was actually right here in Santa Monica, the RAND Corporation. You know, they couldn't believe their eyes, pretty much. They said, this doesn't make any sense at all. The Soviets are just kind of sitting ducks. And what this meant is that America's ability to launch a first strike, to basically wipe out whatever the Soviets could throw at us in a retaliatory strike, America's ability to do so lasted for a whole lot longer than people thought. And that example about Soviet strategic forces, which is so stunning to these people, that it served as the basis for this whole body of thought that spread throughout political science and international relations theory, especially in the 1970s. All right, that's just a digression. We're interested in this, you know, in this whole issue of what the American strategy was. The Americans know that sooner or later, their ability to launch a first strike is going to disappear. The Soviets are going to be able to build a force of sufficient size and survivability that America is not going to be able to do that anymore. And once America is not able to do that anymore, then how are we going to defend Western Europe with our nuclear forces? If we can't use these nuclear forces against the Soviet Union in the event of war for fear of what they would do to us in a retaliatory strike, you know, what's keeping the Soviets at bay in Europe? You know, it's like this is what was called extended deterrence. People distinguish between direct deterrence and extended deterrence. Direct deterrence means your ability to deter a nuclear attack upon your own homeland. Extended deterrence means your ability to deter an attack on your allies, right? The notion is direct deterrence is very strong in the nuclear age. Because no one doubts that if we're attacked we're, in our own homeland, we're certainly going to respond and pull out all the stops against the attackers. But if they attack Western Europe, West Germany, West Berlin, are we going to really commit suicide by escalating to the level of a nuclear war in such a case? Right. And if not, maybe it makes sense to reduce the burden on ourselves of making these nuclear threats, which, if we implemented them, would be suicidal. reduce the burden on ourselves and transfer the burden to the Europeans themselves. You know, let them develop deterrents of their own, because direct deterrence on their part is so powerful. Just as Soviets don't need to match the United States bomb for bomb and bomber for bomber in order to kind of basically neutralize the America's first strike capability. So, say the Germans wouldn't need to be able to build a nuclear force as large as the Soviets had in order to deter the Soviets. As long as they had a secure retaliatory capability, the Soviets attack West Germany, that would mean, you know, a massive counterattack against the Soviets. A second strike force of that sort would provide a degree of security for Germany so that Germany wouldn't have to depend on the United States. Right? And so the Americans think there's a, you know, it's not foolish from our point of view to move in that direction, to have the Europeans carry more of the burden of their own defense. And the Europeans, for their part, including the Germans, because this is one of the big myths about this period, that the people say the Germans never wanted nuclear weapons. Just not true. The Germans understood all of these things, and they felt that they had to develop a nuclear capability while they still could. And the great chancellor, founding chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany, Konrad Adenauer, clearly thought in those terms. There's this one comment he made when he's talking about nuclear weapons, I think it's like 1956 or 1957. He says, we must produce them. We got to build them. Oppenheimer was this old man. He kind of came of age politically, you know, in the late 19th century. It's like about, you know, he could not conceive of a world where the American presence of in Europe is a permanent fact of life. He was fully aware of the fragility of the American nuclear umbrella as the Soviets built up their own nuclear forces. He felt Germany, in order to provide for its own security, purely defensive term, you know, a purely defensive goal, Germany had to build up nuclear forces of its own. He understood people didn't trust the Germans, even people in the West, Germany's closest allies and friends, didn't trust them entirely. So he wanted to kind of go not just the German national route, but to the extent possible a European route. Very, very important to build these European institutions, build up the, you know, European common market and so on. Work together with the French, maybe have some sort of Franco-German force, because an independent European nuclear force was always much, much more palatable to the rest of the world and even to substantial elements within Germany itself than a purely German national force, because of the connotation that German nationalism had come to acquire as a result of the events of the first half of the 20th century. Right? So the Germans want to go that route. And the Americans understand all these things. Eisenhower especially, he wants to help the Europeans acquire a nuclear capability. He wants them to be able to defend themselves. He doesn't want America to have to be Europe's great protector forever. Yeah, sure, for the time being, you know, we need to provide this umbrella for them while they're coming together and building up their forces. But in the long run, you know, they're going to have to defend themselves. You know, we want real partners. We don't want just kind of wards of the United States, satellites. Right? That's not the Eisenhower concept. All right. Why is all this stuff important? Because it relates to the kind of core issue that we're concerned with in this part of the course, which is, you know, how do you explain the Cold War? And conversely, how do you explain why a stable system eventually came into being in the Cold War period? Right? And we how we've been looking at this. We look at these different points when it seemed that a stable system might have been coming into being, 1945, 1949, 1954, and then we say, yeah, but they don't work. What happens? Well, all three of those cases, you know, very, very soon after these arrangements are worked out, you have a new crisis, right? You know, what's going on here? the 1954 system. You know, constrain German sovereignty, limited German power. But that implies the Americans are in. And Soviet power is balanced by a coalition, this NATO coalition, whose backbone is American military power, and especially the American presence in Europe. Right? Germany's freedom of action is limited. Germany is embedded in this structure dominated by the United States. And so on the one hand, there's not much that Germany can do in terms of acting independently. On the other hand, they don't have much an incentive to act independently because a much stronger country, strongest country in the world, the United States, is there, right on German territory, clearly holding the Soviets at bay. So the Germans could accept it. Soviets could accept it because it limits Germany's political freedom, ability to act independently, to agitate for a revisionist policy, a policy aimed at, you know, the reunification of their country, maybe, you know, expelling the communists from areas that they had come to control at the end of the war. You know, as long as Germany is weak, and as long as Germany is dependent on the three Western powers for protection, Germany can't pursue a revisionist policy because she's dependent on those other countries. You know, America is not going to tolerate, you know, actions which could lead to a war with the Soviet Union for the sake of German national goals, and certainly not the British or the French, dead set against it. And as long as Germany is dependent on these essentially status quo powers, Soviets don't have much to worry about. They can accept the 1954 arrangements. They don't want a strong Germany, and they understand that there are two sides to the coin. You keep Germany weak means that the Americans got to stay in. The Americans pull out, Germans have no alternative but to build up their power and develop nuclear forces. You want to keep Germany non-nuclear, you got to accept the NATO system, right? You know, Soviets could accept it, the Germans could accept it, variety of reasons, like, you know, just touching the top of the iceberg here. But there's one big problem here. You know, it takes three, you know, the other expression, it takes two to tango. Well, in this case, it takes three to tango. Kind of odd dance, but the Americans have to be willing to go along with it, too. The Americans have to be willing to play this role. Because if the Americans pull out and you just have Germany and Russia, each afraid of each other, each building up against each other, each kind of threatening each other, well, you know, that's the security dilemma. That's the spiral dynamic. And if you want to kind of keep that in check, if you want to kind of blunt the edge of the security dilemma, kind of soften it, you need the United States to impose itself as a kind of cushion between Germany and Russia so that the Soviets don't have to worry about Germany and the Germans don't have to worry about Russia because there's the Americans at the That's, you know, that's the way you can kind of think about this whole thing, right? And so if we want to understand why this 1954 arrangement doesn't work, we have to look at American policy. And what was American policy? The key thing here is that the Americans reluctantly under Truman, by the like July or August of 1951, you know, Secretary of State Acheson had kind of reluctantly come to the conclusion of we're stuck in Europe. We had wanted a freestanding Europe, the Europeans to come together, balance the Soviets on their own. We provide them protection in the interim period while they are doing that. But ultimately, we want to get out. Well, you know, all the stuff of a European army, the European defense community, even the Marshall Plan, all, you know, European unification, all that stuff is to be understood in that context. Acheson says it just can't work. It can't work. He comes to that conclusion. He's convinced by some key American diplomats that there is no purely European solution to the European security problem, and for the security problem to be resolved, the Americans have to stay in. You know, it's not like Imperial America wants to come in, throw its weight around. We're sucked in, kicking and screaming practically, very grudgingly under under Acheson, but still we do it, right? That's from mid-50, 51 through the year 52, that's the American policy. January 1953, we get a new president, Dwight Eisenhower, right? Eisenhower had a very clear understanding of what he wanted to do. He's not a cipher by any means, much more important in terms of shaping American policy than Truman had been. And Eisenhower had been the first SACUR, first NATO commander in 1951. You read what he said, you know, 1951, Eisenhower concept comes through loud and clear. What does Eisenhower want? He wants a freestanding Europe. He wants the Europeans to come together in a federal union. You know? He wants the Europeans to develop enough military power so that they could keep the Soviets at bay by themselves without much, if any, of a direct American military contribution in the long run. Yeah, sure, for the time being, we have to be there while all these things are happening, but it's very clear Eisenhower wants to get out. And it's like, you want to understand this sort of thing? I spent a lot of time in the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas. You go in the middle of Kansas, middle of the heartlands, you know, to get there you have to drive through miles and miles of these rolling wheat fields and so on. You're there and the rest of the world seems a million miles away. It's like, that's the Eisenhower concept. We are not cut out for the imperial role. We are not a modern Rome to be guarding the far-flung reaches of our empire. That's not who we are as a nation, right? And these Europeans, they have the wherewithal, they have the men, they have the economic strength, technological capability to defend themselves as long as they come together. We got to push them to come together. You know, a big part of the Eisenhower policy. You know, a lot of this building Europe stuff is not in America's economic interest, you know. Because what do we mean by a common market? It means that they don't have tariffs. These European countries in the common market, they don't have internal tariffs when they're trading with each other, but they have external tariffs so that other trading partners of theirs are going to find it harder to sell in the European market. Basically, by definition, this means that they're discriminating against the United States in favor of each other. It's not to our economic interest to promote things like the common market. We do it because it's in our political interest, or at least perceived political interest, to have Europe come together as this kind of counterweight. It's not that we want to keep them weak and divided so that they'll be forced into dependence on ourselves. We want them to be strong and united so they could take care of their own problems and leave us alone. Right? That's the and the implication, the direct implication of this is that they ultimately are going to have nuclear forces under their own control. And if not, if you can't have a federal Europe, then at least have them have national nuclear forces that are knitted together within the Western system, within the NATO system. And as the American involvement in Europe diminishes, NATO will devolve into a purely European defense organization. The NATO commander, SACUR, will cease to be an American general, and he'll be replaced by a European. Eisenhower always said a French general should be the NATO commander. Yeah, that's their concept. Strategic independence, right? Not an American protectorate. Nuclear forces under their control, including under national control, including under German control. Right? Important, very important. Because you could see how the Soviets would react to this sort of thing. But that's not the only taproot of the nuclear sharing policy. There are these two other taproots. The second was MC-48, the strategy for the defense of Western Europe. And defense, not deterrence. The defense of Western Europe, adopted by the NATO Council in December of 1954. This is just an absolutely extraordinary document. High watermark of the emphasis on nuclear weapons in Western defense strategy during the entire Cold War period. One and only one way in which Europe can be defended in the event of war. That was by massive, concentrated, and above all, extremely rapid use of nuclear weapons, both strategically and in the theater. And it's like, that's what MC-48 called for. No matter how the war broke out, this is what how they were going to fight. We could do this because of this huge buildup of American power, especially nuclear power, that was now manifest, the result of the decisions made at the end of 1950, which had finally paid off in terms of military end products by the end of the Truman period, by late 52. And now they're capitalizing on this huge edge in terms of military capabilities. War breaks out. If we strike hard enough and fast enough, the Soviets will be totally wiped out, and they won't be able to get off hardly anything against us or even against our friends in Western Europe if we neutralize their forces the way we should. It's quite extraordinary, both in terms of what it provided for and what its implications were. And it's important to remember the three implications of the nuclear sharing policy. What are these three implications? Preemption, pre-delegation. I'm sorry. There are three implications of MC-48. Preemption, pre-delegation, and nuclear sharing. Preemption means we got to go first, right? Even before they begin any military action. As soon as we're convinced that war is inevitable, the balloon goes up. Execute the emergency war plans, both in Europe and in the intercontinental attack. Again, important because people think, oh, the United States is this nice, sweet, defensive country. We will never start a war. Except, of course, this terrible George W. Bush, who broke with this American tradition and started a war. But normally, America never does that sort of thing. You know, it's part of the whole set of myths that that people have in this country about these things. Just, no one takes the trouble to understand this stuff. Right? Okay. This is the Eisenhower policy was called massive retaliation. In fact, in the words of David Rosenberg, who's studied these issues more closely than anyone else, he says, massive retaliation really meant massive preemption. We're going to go first, because how can you rely on nuclear weapons if you don't go first? Are you going to let the other side use its nuclear forces against you first? So, oh no, the whole premise, the condition for relying on nuclear attack is that we are not going to suffer damage to our own homeland, and that means we got to destroy the enemy's nuclear forces before they can get off the ground and hurt us, and that implies we got to move very fast. Indeed, even before the enemy has begun a military operation, as soon as we're convinced that war is inevitable. Implication one. Implication two is pre-delegation. If you got to move fast, you can't, let me use my native dialect, you can't putz around. You can't putz around with consultations and asking all the NATO allies, Greece and Luxembourg and Portugal and Iceland and so on, whether they're willing to kind of go along with this, right? You scarcely have time to consult even with your major allies, the three big ones, Britain, France, and West Germany. And maybe you don't even have all that much time to talk about these things with the president and the secretary of state. If action has to be taken very, very fast, then the decision has to be pre-delegated to the person who has the information needed to make that quick decision. And that's the NATO commander, Sakyr, first half of the Eisenhower administration is Eisenhower's closest personal friend. He had basically maneuvered to put this guy in that position. His name was Grunther. And the second half was General Norstad. Sakyr under Eisenhower was a very important position. This is not just a normal military commander who takes his orders from Washington and so on. He has this independent power resulting from these pre-delegation arrangements. That doesn't mean that he's going to be a rogue general and just go off entirely on his own. He's going to be doing a lot of consulting as the crisis is developing. But, you know, at the moment of truth, his views are going to be decisive. Now, why is this important? Because it helps solve one of the basic European security problems, which is, how can you rely on the United States? You know, why should the Europeans, you know, put their whole security in the hands of this foreign power, no matter how well-intentioned? A power based on the other side of this huge ocean. The answer is, well, we can do various things that could mitigate those concerns. Pre-delegation was one of them. Why did pre-delegation have that effect? You all know the whole theory of virtual representation from the pre-revolutionary period in the history of our country. This whole idea was the American colonists in those days, they didn't need to be represented in the British Parliament because there are people in England whose interests were the same as those of the colonists, and these people were represented in Parliament, and the interests of the American colonists would be represented by them. Virtual representation. Well, it was the same sort of thing with Sackyer. Sackyer, this was this guy every hour of every day. He was just thinking about how Western Europe could be defended. Right? He was more, you know, kind of structurally concerned with this issue than even any of the Europeans were. And it was a source of reassurance to the Europeans that American power would be brought into play, that these that a big degree of war-making power was pre-delegated to Sackyer, and that he had that kind of independent authority. This stuff is going to be important because we're going to see how Sackyer's wings were clipped during the Kennedy period. But under Eisenhower, this is part of the whole system that was in place. Okay? But the most important implication of MC-48 for our purposes is, once again, nuclear sharing. See, nuclear weapons are the only weapons that are important in the event of a war. Well, the conventional stuff is just, you know, playing with marbles, they said. So if the Europeans were to count for anything, they should be armed with nuclear weapons. Right? You're asking the Europeans to put all their trust in you? Right, that you're actually going to take these very dramatic events in the event that their security was threatened? They're supposed to kind of place the, you know, life and death kind of issues in your hands? Trust that you're going to be dealing with them satisfactorily? Well, could you then pursue a policy that was based on mistrust of them? Say, oh, we shouldn't allow the Europeans to control nuclear weapons. We don't trust them. Say, no. These issues are so serious that only operational military considerations should come into play. Right. Whatever increased, preparedness for conflict, you know, military effectiveness, you know, functional military considerations. These should be, determining, dispositive, and that implied, you know, it's like the same reasons why you wanted these American troops to be armed with nuclear weapons. It should apply to the French, the British, the Germans, the Dutch, whatever. Okay. So it's clear that nuclear sharing, helping the Europeans get control of nuclear weapons so that they didn't need an okay from Washington. This is also a direct implication of MC-48. I mean, these are things you could kind of prove textually by citing documents. And then finally, the third taproot of the nuclear sharing policy was the sense that America, sure, it had the upper hand now, could contemplate a first strike now, but sooner or later, it wouldn't be able to do so in anything like the way it was able to do so in the mid-50s. You know, America had a window of opportunity. Remember that notion? We started talking about it in 1914, and then it comes in again in 1941, and You know, then in the early nuclear age and so on, the America's window of opportunity was bound to close. The Soviets were bound to build up strategic forces of a certain absolute level that would make it very hard for America to contemplate a first strike. Right? And when that happened, the Europeans needed something in place that could balance the Soviets on their own, a direct deterrent of their own, because the American extended deterrent was no longer reliable. Extended deterrence is hard to achieve. It means you need a first strike capability. Direct deterrence is much easier to achieve. All you need is a second strike capability. Much harder to achieve a first strike than a second strike capability. First strike capability means you've got to wipe out everything the other side has. Second strike capabilities means you only have to hold on to a certain force that's capable of riding out an attack and going on to destroy the enemy. Right? And the sense was, sooner or later, the Europeans are going to have to be able to stand up to the Soviets on their own, because Americans wouldn't be able to credibly defend them. Right? Three taproots of the strategy. Why is all that important? Because it means that, it tells us a lot about how what was going on in the field was to be taken. Now, it was known from a very early date, like 1960, Joint Committee on Atomic Energy of the Congress, so composed of both senators and congressmen. This committee did an investigation in 1960. They sent people over to Europe to look at how about these custody arrangements for the control of nuclear weapons. They said, oh, this is extremely weak. These Europeans have effective control over American nuclear weapons. This must be because Eisenhower is this kind of doddering old man. He had these heart attacks and strokes and he was totally out of control. He didn't know what he was doing. He couldn't get an articulate sentence out of his mouth. And, you know, all these notions at the time, you just people, you know, especially intellectual types, they, you know, thought Eisenhower was, you know, practically an idiot. I mean, they said the same thing about Reagan, by the way. It turns out that these custody arrangements didn't lax custody arrangements where the Europeans could, had effective control of these American nuclear weapons. They didn't come into being by accident because the president didn't know what was going on and didn't care what was going on. You know, military out of control, you know, all these kind of notions that people have. The fact that all this thinking existed showed, among other things, that the dispersal of nuclear weapons and the fact that the Europeans had effective control over them was to be understood as a deliberate act of policy. Not open policy, by the way, because it wasn't legal for the U.S. government to allow foreigners to get control of our nuclear weapons, right? But because there was this law and they couldn't change it, because this is a Republican administration and the Congress is dominated by the Democrats, who are much more nationalistic about these issues than Eisenhower was, they said, so what they do is this end run around the law. They have these fig leaves that purport to show that America still maintained custody, but the custody arrangements are so fragile and so weak and deliberately designed to be kind of a joke so that the Europeans could know that if push comes shove, they would have control of these weapons. Right? All this stuff is deliberate. Okay. Not just that, but the Americans are also encouraged the Europeans to develop a nuclear infrastructure of their own so that they can build their own bombs, their own delivery systems. We're going to help them with all this stuff. All deliberate, you can prove these things in the documents. Why is this important? If it was just a question of Britain and France getting nuclear capabilities, no one would care. It doesn't affect anything in the slightest. The only reason it matters is because it means that Germany is getting her finger on the nuclear trigger. Why does that matter? It matters because, mainly, this taps into the Soviets' number one security concern in Europe, the problem of what will happen if West Germany becomes strong. A strong West Germany, Germany with nuclear forces on her own, is able to pursue her own independent policy, a policy based on German national goals, the foremost of which is the reunification of their own country, freeing 17 million of their compatriots from the yoke of communist rule. Right. So it's a bound to react. That kind of Germany, an independent Germany, it's not going to be locked into a defensive status quo oriented policy, because she's not going to be dependent on the Western powers, who basically are happy to live with things as they are, vastly preferable to a war. Soviets, again, feel this is very serious. Maybe not right away, but who knows what will happen once the Germans throw off all these constraints. Everyone remembers what happened in the 1920s. Right? There were constraints on German power laid down in Versailles. They didn't last too long. Right? Shouldn't the Soviets try to nip the problem in the bud before it gets totally out of control? Right? And it's not just the Soviets, by the way. It's, you know, people in Western Europe, Germany's neighbors, especially Britain and France, they don't like the idea of a German finger on the nuclear trigger, especially not the British. Okay. How did the Soviets react to all this? This is the context of which the Berlin crisis, the Great Berlin Crisis, the 48-49 thing, was not a crisis in this sense. I always refer to it as the Berlin Blockade Affair, because the risk of war was not nearly as great then as it is in 58 to 62. This, the Great Berlin Crisis, which includes the Cuban Missile Crisis, is this culminating episode, is the climax of this great crisis. This is a central episode of the Cold War. It begins in November of 1958 with the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev laying down this ultimatum, in effect, about Berlin. Don't forget, West Berlin is this western enclave in the middle of communist East Germany. You know, over 100 miles from the nearest point on the West German border, and it's under the military protection of the three Western powers. Not even technically part of West Germany. What exactly is Soviets threatening? Here's their argument. They say, well, a whole lot of time has passed since the end of the war. These provisional arrangements that were reached at the end of the war, including the arrangements about Berlin being divided up into these sectors and so on, this can't be permanent. We have to put an end to all these kind of problems left over from the war, have a definitive settlement. What is the definitive settlement? It's basically everyone should recognize the sort of status quo that's come into being, you know, with the East German state. The East German state should be recognized, which Western powers won't do. And as far as Berlin, they say the natural thing would be for Berlin, the entire city of Berlin, to be absorbed into the East German state, but we understand that the West has special interests there, so we're willing to make certain concessions to them. We're willing to transform West Berlin into a free city, in quotes, where it would retain its, you know, Western economic and political institutions, but the Western powers are going to have to get out. Right? And the Western powers think if they ever get out, what's going to protect West Berlin, right? And the Soviets say, we're in no rush. We will give the West 6 months to negotiate an acceptable arrangement based on our ideas to transform Berlin into a free city and for the Western powers to withdraw. But if they don't do this, and if they have the audacity to try and preserve their rights as occupying powers left over from the war through the use of military force, you know, and East Germany resists the attempt on the part of the West to use military force to keep their access to Berlin open, then we will rise in defense of our East German ally. In other words, he's threatening war if the West doesn't cave into his ultimatum. Right? Why are the Soviets doing this? It's like, this is serious. They're threatening kind of clear rights that the Western powers had and insisting on that they be changed on a unilateral basis. Why are they doing this? Well, I mean, here you have to kind of speculate to a certain extent, or at least try and hold up the different interpretations to the light and see which stand up in terms of evidence and in terms of their internal logic, you know, which makes sense. Why would the Soviets want to kick the Western powers out of Berlin? I say, well, you say, well, they're just aggressive people. They're looking forward to a war or so on. And so that's absurd, given their military weakness. I mean, if they wanted a war, or even wanted a serious crisis, why would they even give the West this kind of six-month deadline to kind of prepare for it? And it's like, you know, that's not the case. You know, it's not the case that, oh, you know, East Germany is being bled white by the loss of its most skilled citizens, you know, who can flee to the West, you know, from one half of Berlin to the other. In order to maintain the viability of the East German state, the Soviets have to stabilize the situation by putting a stop to that, solving the Berlin problem. If that was their concern, they could have dealt with it the way they dealt with it in 1961, simply by sealing off the two parts of the city. You know, and the East Germans proposed that to the Soviets. The Soviets said, no, we don't want to do that because we have bigger fish to fry. In other words, we're concerned with West Germany as a whole. Khrushchev himself says to various Western representatives that Berlin is a lever. You know, it's a source of weakness for the West, and he intends to take advantage of that. And in fact, take advantage of that in order to achieve what? To change Western policy vis-a-vis West Germany, not West Berlin, West Germany. And in particular, to do something about this nuclear sharing policy that's enabling the West Germans at exactly this point in time to get control of nuclear forces, in fact, of American nuclear forces. They have de facto control, or development. Khrushchev wants to force the West to negotiate these issues. Okay. How does the West react to all of this? Does it understand that that's the Soviet goal? Certain glimmers of it, but they don't put this at the center of their analysis of what the Soviets are up to. In part because the Soviets can't be too clear about this. I mean, you just think of this in bargaining terms. Here, the Soviet Union is basically the weaker of the two superpowers. And how does it compensate for that weakness? Well, one way is by not revealing that it's afraid of anything, by pretending that it's, you know, made of steel. They can rely on projecting that image of being very bellicose in order to get the West to back down, right? It's something that they project. It's a form of play acting. I mean, there's this famous episode where Khrushchev has an interview with Averell Harriman, who was an important official under Roosevelt and Truman. He had been ambassador to the Soviet Union during the war. And Harriman comes back and writes an article in Life magazine, kind of a mass circulation magazine at that time. He says, my alarming interview with Khrushchev. And Khrushchev is, you know, making all these threats. The bombs will fly if you dare to, you know, use force to kind of maintain your rights in Berlin. Then you look at the record of this meeting in the archives. It turns out, you know, Khrushchev was kind of drunk at the time. He had been... But it's a tactic that they use in order to kind of get the Americans to back down, to present themselves as much more warlike than they in fact are. Americans don't give way. Eisenhower's whole attitude is, We're going to be firm without being truculent. Americans, Eisenhower is so sure of America's strategic position that he doesn't feel any need to resort to threats. It's going to be different under Kennedy, by the way. Yeah? They take measures that indicate their readiness for a war that they know that Soviet intelligence is going to pick up, military measures, which they don't want the public to know about because they're worried that the public is going to be frightened. But they're not going to back down, right? It doesn't mean that they're absolutely intransigent. One or two more sentences. They're willing to negotiate, but the negotiations don't work. And what is the upshot of the failure of the negotiations? A war? Khrushchev complies with his ultimatum, brings matters to a head. No, it doesn't happen like that. He says this threat strategy didn't work with Eisenhower. Maybe we could try again in the future. Maybe we'll be stronger. Maybe we'll have better luck with Eisenhower's successor. And in fact, it's under Kennedy in the 61 to 62 period that all this business comes to a head. And that's what I'm going to be trying to talk about next time. Okay, thanks.